Hello, my sweet love miners of the apocalypse. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And this is part two in a series of podcasts I'm doing about the folks who are making great efforts to get MDMA legalized. I actually am just calling it a series. It just coincidentally happens that I interviewed two people in a row who happen to be working really hard to change the draconian, archaic, monolithic, Machiavellian, and ridiculous drug laws that are keeping people locked up behind bars with murderers for doing nothing more than trying to expand their consciousness or trying to expand the consciousness of folks around them. You guys know how I feel about this. I hope I'm not seeming too one note. If you just started listening to the podcast last episode because of Rick Doblin, please don't think that the only thing we talk about on this podcast is the legalization of drugs, though I do find it an interesting topic, and though it is something I love talking about, it's not the only thing we talk about, and I hope that if you are bored with this subject matter, you will forgive me and trust me when I say we've got a lot of great podcasts coming up that don't have to do with the fact that alchemists and chemists and teachers and saints and people who only wanted to love a little bit more, or people who are hurting really bad and just using what they had at their disposal to try to escape the pain, are currently festering in the dungeons of the Illuminati or whoever the fuck is behind the prison industrial complex. I have a feeling it isn't the Illuminati. It's probably just a bunch of grumpy, scared people, and nothing as sinister as it seems if you think about it too hard. We got some great podcasts coming up. Pete Holmes is going to be on the show this Thursday. My friend Johnny Ross, who is one of the leaders in the virtual reality community, is going to be on the podcast, and then we can get right back into talking about the other strange stuff that's currently happening in the world. But I do think it's important, since it is spring, we did just celebrate the resurrection of Jesus, to spend a little bit of time talking with folks who understand that there are certain powerful medicinal psychoactive chemicals out there that need to be brought out of the dark of prohibition and see the light of day, so that all the stigma currently attached to these substances can be lifted and people can begin to experience the benefits that come from these substances. And when I say these substances, generally what I'm talking about is psilocybin or magic mushrooms, MDMA, marijuana, dimethyltryptamine, which is ayahuasca, and any safe, time-honored substance that has very little negative repercussions, and if used responsibly and moderately with good intention and surrounded by people you trust and love, can have supremely powerful outcomes when it comes to your ability to connect with the people around you and to forgive people that perhaps desperately need your forgiveness. They also help with understanding myth. They're great lenses that you can revisit the religions that you may have been raised with. A lot of folks were raised in fundamentalist, conservative households where whatever the story being told was, for a lot of folks, that's fundamentalist Christianity. For a lot of folks, that's Pentecostal Christianity. That story, sometimes because it's being told by scared people or people who have been taught to fear the Lord, it gets tainted. And so you end up missing this incredible information packet that's encapsulated in all the symbols that make up the story of Jesus Christ, or whatever religion you were raised in. If you were given it the wrong way, then you're going to have the same response to Christianity that I currently have whenever I smell absinthe. I can't drink absinthe anymore. I used to really enjoy absinthe, not just because I'm a closet goth, but because it's a really interesting tasting alcohol. But ever since I did Drunk History, whenever I get around absinthe, it just makes me want to puke. In the same way, because of my body's trying to protect me and telling me, oh shit, man, that's poison. I almost killed us once. There's some metaphysical or perhaps neurological part of the human brain that after you have been exposed to fundamentalism and you revisit it, you have a poison response. Your body contracts, you clench your forehead down, and whoever happens to be yapping about sweet baby Jesus, you just want to tell him to go shove it where the fucking sun doesn't shine, you proselytizing, holier-than-thou piece of shit. I am an adult, and I don't have to eat these poison pellets that were fed to me every Sunday when I was a kid. But if you take a psychedelic and revisit those stories, quite often you will recognize that the stories weren't what was fucked up, but the people who were telling them had twisted agendas that didn't really have much to do with the myth that they were telling you. That's another reason psychedelics are great. Psychedelics are great if you're having the inevitable sort of stagnant period that can come in a long-term relationship. Lots of folks have that. It's completely normal to have that. If you're hanging out with somebody all the time, that initial burst of firework-like passion can diminish, and suddenly it feels like you're eating stale crackers and watching a black and white I Love Lucy rerun instead of enjoying that incredible, passionate, love-filled fuck fest that your relationship used to be. What happened to the showers you would take together where you'd scrub each other off and pretend you were in some kind of 90s softcore porn? What happened to listening to Enigma and rubbing coconut oil in each other's moobs? It's gone. It just vanishes. And the next thing you know, you're just like wafting farts on each other and praying for death. It can happen. But the a responsible MDMA session done in the right way with the right intentions behind it, the right prayers intoned, the right sigils written down can bring you right back into that passionate, sweet, beautiful, connective place that you experience when you first met whoever it is you've been with for a long time. So that's another reason psychedelics are incredibly useful. And all the research is out there. You can see the research happening with giving psilocybin to folks who have late-stage terminal illnesses, who are more than likely about to exit the casino and are feeling the kind of anxiety that goes along with knowing you're going to die. And somewhere in the process of taking a high dose of psilocybin, you realize that this ego identity, this human body, this vortex of atoms and memories and essentially this bag of meat that you've gotten so fixated on is just one infinitesimal part of what you actually are. Because sometimes a good mushroom trip done in the right way can show you that what is waiting for you after the death of the body is very similar to somebody who's been living in Syria for their entire lives going to visit Hawaii. It's almost like that. And you realize that the what is waiting for you is so beautiful and profound and incredible and familiar that the fear that you are experiencing, or a lot of the fear that you are experiencing in relation to that inevitable event that every single person on the planet living today will more than likely experience, unless you believe Ray Kurzweil, in which case we're all going to get broken apart by nanobots and go drifting into space and turn the moon into a Commodore 64 or something. I hope that happens, but it may be that we're all going to die. And in that, and so psychedelics can alleviate a lot of the anxiety and tension that all of us are probably secretly feeling, at least in some small way. So that's another excellent use for psychedelics. There's a lot of other great uses for psychedelics too, and I could probably go on for about 700 hours hours listing all of them, but I'm not going to do that. Just know that this is the second part of a two-part series on the legalization of MDMA, and we've got a lot of other topics that are going to come up. We don't just talk about drugs on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Much thanks to the AV Club for giving me a review on the Rick Doblin episode. Reviews are interesting. Sometimes it feels like they gotta throw in a tiny little jab, and the critique that I got in the review from the AV Club was that I'm gonna misquote it. You can Google search it, but it seems like they thought that I was ascribing a little too much benefit to these substances, and that maybe they're not gonna fix every problem in your life. I will concede that point. I don't think that they're gonna fix every problem in your life, but I do think that they're going to help you as you address all the problems in your life with a brand new set of goggles on. They're gonna help you look at the problems in your life in a brand new way, and they're gonna help you deal with some of the difficulty that you've been experiencing in creative ways that you might otherwise not have thought of. To sum it up, they're gonna help you forgive everybody who's ever done any shitty thing to you, and in the process, you're going to forgive yourself. And so, in that way, I think they are a wonderful tool that can be used, that should be used responsibly, and should be used along with perhaps therapy or meditation or just a general desire to evolve yourself so that you can be a more giving, gentle, compassionate, and empathetic member of whatever community you happen to have incarnated into. Okay, my friends? Okay. So, we're going to dive right into this podcast. Now, listen, I've got to call somebody out here. My dear friend and teacher, Raghu Marcus, was at the Whole Foods in Asheville, North Carolina, and encountered a grocery clerk who was working there who recommended for him to listen to the Rick Doblin episode. So thank you, my friend, for doing that. And then complained about my commercials that I do on this podcast. And he said he doesn't want to fucking hear about somebody yapping about web design. So look, I understand, friend. I get it. You know what? I don't necessarily want to hear commercials either. They annoy me when I'm watching The Walking Dead, and they're there in the middle of the fucking action. A goddamn car commercial comes on. I'm getting ripped apart by zombies. I'm afraid my sweet dear Sheriff Rick might be about to get murdered. My sweet, sweet man who I wish could protect me in everything that I do in the real world. I wish Sheriff Rick lived with me and guided me every step of the way. And anytime him or his friends get into danger, I don't want to see some bullshit about a goddamn antidepressant or a car commercial. But I have to go through that. They interrupt it. That's what I'm saying. They interrupt the show several times with these goddamn commercials. I, sweet friend at Whole Foods in Asheville, North Carolina, put the commercials in the very fucking beginning of this goddamn podcast, which means that if you take the slightest amount of time, and maybe I'm wrong about this, maybe whatever system you're using doesn't have a keyboard or a mouse and you can't just jump forward, but I think you can just jump forward. That's all, just jump forward. Are you really not willing to expend that amount of energy to... It's probably 4 calories, is my guess. It's half a cracker's worth of calories to jump ahead in my rambling commercials. And I will admit sometimes they're too long. And I will admit that sometimes I go on and on about them, and I shouldn't. But the reason I do that is because something about just reading off the paper makes me feel like some kind of robotic shill. And I don't know. I just don't want to, like, do the whole like newsreel thing where you just read the copy and then move on. So that's why I do it. Maybe I'll figure out the time codes or something. And for those of you who don't want to listen, and obviously I'm the opposite of offended that you wouldn't want to listen to a commercial. But for those of you who don't want to listen, you could just dive ahead, move into the next phase, jump right into the interview. You don't have to listen to me ramble about some crap you're not interested. Just jump ahead. Do that for me, would you? All that being said, I'm not going to do a commercial for this particular podcast. I'm not going to do any of the Casper, Squarespace, or any of those. But I am going to do my, I am going to talk about the Amazon portal for a second. You could have already jumped ahead. Are you still listening? You could have already jumped ahead. Is it that hard? I want you to be happy. I want you, Whole Foods clerk, to be happy. In fact, at this moment, I'm thinking of the unified consciousness of all things, the love field that we are all a part of, and I'm imagining that all sentient beings at this very moment in the universe are pumping your life filled with the most incredible blessings, synchronicities, coincidence, joys. You're seeing fucking, I'm monarch butterflies. That's what I'm imagining. I'm imagining you're waking up in the morning, your window is flying open, and just a bustle. Is that what you call a swarm of monarch butterflies? A bustle of monarchs has come soaring into your room, and their beautiful orange wings are flapping, and they're flapping synchronistically so that the drone of their flap starts making the om sound over your bed. And any dying flowers that you have around your room or any dying things that you have around your room are coming back to life. And you are getting younger because of this magical butterfly event. That's what I want for you. I want you to be happy and to enjoy this podcast, but I got to do commercials because that's what pays the bills. So I'm sorry you don't enjoy them. And I thank you for recommending the podcast to Raghu. But for God's sakes, man, just jump ahead, okay? All right. This episode of the Doug and Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Amazon.com. Thank you. All of you have been going through the Amazon portal. It's a great way for you to support this podcast. If you go to any episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast and click through the Amazon portal, the next time you're going to buy something on Amazon, they give us a very small percentage of what you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything. So it's a way for you to support this podcast, and you really are supporting the podcast when you do it. It really adds up. So it's a way for you to support the podcast without having to do anything more than to buy some delectable, delightful, wonderful thing from those sweet, sweet babies over at Amazon.com. They literally have everything there. Everything that you need. In the big cities, they're going to bring you groceries if you want them. They have everything. You never have to leave your house. You could literally float in a flotation tank for the rest of your life, have your groceries delivered. They're actually, I think Amazon is actually like sending workers over to fix your house. My guess is in the future, they're going to have doctors. You're going to be able to press a button on your browser, and within probably 20 or 30 minutes, a team of plastic surgeons will be at your house, Botoxing your wrinkles, injecting your scrotum with sweet honey so that you ejaculate just glorious globs of delicious honey that you can spray into your breads and the mouths of your lovers and pets. Go through our portal, won't you? It's at DuncanTrussell.com in the comments section of any episode. And we are also going on tour, friends. Ooh, yeah, and I've got a really big announcement. I am so excited about this, man. So first I'll go through the dates. Some of these are already sold out. The show in Cambridge, Massachusetts on April 23rd is sold out. Brooklyn is sold out. So there's basically three shows left on the tour that have not sold out yet. Philadelphia, Arlington, and the Improv on the 18th of April. At the Improv on the 18th of April in Hollywood, we've got Daniele Bellelli. Abby Martin's going to be in Arlington, Virginia. In Philadelphia, we've got Cambridge, we've got Johnny Pemberton and Lou Barlow at the Sinclair, but that's sold out. Sorry. In Philadelphia, it's Johnny Pemberton at the Trocadero. Here's my big announcement. On the 26th in Brooklyn, if you weren't able to get tickets to those shows, we have added a third show. This third show is not a live podcast. This third show is an end of tour party. We're going to have amazing DJs, and Alex and Allison Gray are going to be painting. If you don't know who Alex and Allison Gray are, check out the Alex and Allison Gray episode. This is going to be super, super fun. I'm going to be hanging out. Emil's going to be hanging out. It's just going to be a way for all of us to unwind after this tour and hang out together and watch Alex and Allison Gray paint while some incredible DJs play some insanely good music. So I will have that link up on the website very soon. The proceeds, 100% of the proceeds from this party will go to COSM. They're going to go to Alex and Allison Gray's foundation to help those sweet, incredible artists continue to be conduits for the art that flows through them into this dimension and certainly brings me a shit ton of happiness. So please come out to that show. It's going to be a blast. Come to any of these shows. I really hope that I will see you there. Today's guest is Emmanuel Sfirios. You might know him as the founder of DanceSafe.org, which is an organization that used to test MDMA at raves to make sure that it was actually ecstasy and not some deadly poison, some Jim Jones shit being sold by an unscrupulous, greedy drug dealer. He is currently working on a movie called MDMAthemovie.com. There's an Indiegogo fundraising account for that if you're interested in pitching in a little bit to get this movie made. I'll have links to that at DuncanTrussell.com. He's an activist, and he's working really hard to get the ridiculous drug policies related to MDMA reformed, and it was super cool to have a chat with him. So I hope you will all connect your psychic microtubules and squeeze your pineal gland tight so that all that sweet love goo goes shooting down the transcendent conduits that connect all human beings to each other and lands right in the sweetest spot of Emmanuel Sfirios's spine so that he experiences a temporary blast of pure nirvanic love bliss. Everybody now, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Emmanuel Sfirios. Emmanuel Sfirios, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. You are the founder of DanceSafe.org. Can you tell me a little bit about what DanceSafe.org is?
Sure. DanceSafe is more than a website. It's actually a harm reduction organization. It has chapters now in 12 cities throughout the U.S. Harm reduction provides an alternative to the just say no model of drug education, operating under the philosophy that there will always be people who choose to use drugs, and if they do, they should do so as safely as possible until they decide to quit. And so DanceSafe provides truthful, non-judgmental drug education and services to young people in the electronic dance music community, where ecstasy, or Molly now as the younger generation calls it, is widely used.
So you guys, I remember seeing documentaries about it and stuff popping up about it and just being kind of amazed that somehow you could legally test people's ecstasy at raves. I didn't understand. How come you didn't get arrested for doing that?
Well, you know, Duncan, I fully planned to be arrested. It just never happened. I found a needle exchange attorney in the San Francisco Bay Area where I lived, and I was like, this is going to save lives, and perhaps it's technically against the law because we're touching controlled substances, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I was sort of, you know, expecting it to happen, but it actually didn't. We ended up working cooperatively with local health departments and even local police in a number of cities around the country. That was back in the early days. The politics have changed a little bit since then. Ironically, it's kind of gotten worse, and that was when the federal government came in and passed a piece of legislation called the RAVE Act. Senator Biden passed it, now vice president back then, and it basically expanded the crack house laws to commercial venues,
right,
which could prosecute promoters or club owners if they were, quote unquote, maintaining a drug involved premises. This real vague language, you know, what does it actually mean? But it sent a chill through the industry. And when that happened, the promoters were more reluctant to welcome DanceSafe in to do this harm reduction work.
It just seems to me, it seems like such an easy thing. If I was a cop and I was going to a rave and I wanted to bus people, it seems like all I'd have to do is stand near the DanceSafe table and wait for people to come up and reveal that they had drugs and then arrest them. How come cops didn't do that?
Well, a lot of the events back then, Duncan, were sort of underground events. They did hire private security, but, you know, everyone, you know, sort of knew that there were drugs there. And the strategy in these underground events at the time was, let's try to keep people safe because we're not going to be able to stop people from getting drugs in. And that's been demonstrated today, where a lot of these major festivals like Electric Zoo in New York implement draconian search policies with, you know, dogs that supposedly can sniff out drugs, etc. And they can't stop people from getting their drugs in. Or even worse, young people will see the dogs, get scared, and then they'll take all their drugs at once before they come in. Which can more easily cause problems, overdose, et cetera.
So it's your philosophy and the philosophy of DanceSafe seems pretty logical, which is that the making drugs illegal is not stopping anyone from doing drugs.
It never has. That's correct. And so harm reduction is, you know, it can coexist with a law enforcement model, as it does in many countries somewhat successfully, the Netherlands being a good example, where the government actually funds harm reduction services, including drug checking, pill testing services that I started doing with DanceSafe, where we actually would test people's ecstasy to help them avoid ingesting the pills that contained PMA, paramethoxyamphetamine, and many other drugs that are being sold as ecstasy or Molly now that are far more dangerous. The Dutch government actually does this themselves. That's where I modeled DanceSafe off of the Netherlands program. So, you know, ecstasy is still illegal in the Netherlands, but the government takes a public health approach towards the illicit use.
What's the difference between you and everybody else who's taken ecstasy, realized it's great, and then has done nothing for the community? What got you, what made you decide to take steps to create this organization?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of people who have done a lot of great things for the rave community. And ironically, I actually wasn't a part of the rave community when I started DanceSafe. I had used ecstasy back when I was a teenager. I was 16, but I didn't get it at a rave. I actually read an article in Newsweek about the drug being used in therapy,
right?
And said, "Hey, I wanted to try this to gain the insights." And I was dealing with a lot of issues from my own childhood. Searched it out and found it, and did it, and it was very, very helpful to me. And it's a very powerful medicine. And I can't say every time I did it was strictly therapeutic back when I was a teenager. You know, I had some house parties and I turned some friends onto it. And probably there's a couple year period there where I took the drug a dozen times or so. And then I forgot about it, you know, went to college and, you know, traveled around. And now here I am living in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1998. And a friend of mine gives me some ecstasy again. And now we have the internet. Now I can really learn. What do we know in the last 10 years, right? What have we learned? And I was blown away by what had happened to the illicit market. It was incredible because back in 86, when I did it, there was no fear when you bought ecstasy. that you were going to get some deadly drug. It was pretty much all MDMA back then. And now it was the most – it had become, even back in 1998, the most highly adulterated illicit drug market in the world. And I discovered the Dutch program to help users and just said, hey, I'm going to do that here. I had been an activist for many years and had done needle exchange volunteer work and also worked in downtown Oakland with inner city families whose, you know, mostly African-American families who had, you know, male relatives in prison for 10 years or life for, you know, a handful of, you know, rocks of crack cocaine. And so I had already an understanding of how the drug war was not just failing, but it was actually causing most of the problems.
Well, that's what I'm really curious about. And I know that I hope that you don't think I'm getting too far away from ecstasy, but I'm really curious about that moment in a person's life where they go from being a consumer to being an activist. Like what's that first move that you made in the direction of starting Dance Safe? When were you like, okay, I'm going to do something to help?
These are great questions. And no one's ever asked me this before, you know? And so the truth is I was an activist on other issues before that, as I just explained, one of them being a homeless rights. I worked for, you may have heard of this international organization, Food Not Bombs.
Yes.
Yeah, so I was a Food Not Bombs activist in Berkeley for 4 years. And one of the things that we did, we weren't just advocates for homeless rights. We were also a direct service for homeless people. We cooked and served vegetarian meals 5 days a week in Berkeley and served in People's Park. Not just for the homeless, it was anyone can eat, right? Students ate with us. It was, you know, picnic atmosphere and that's kind of, you know, and then on top of it, we did advocacy too. And through that, I learned that the best way to affect social change is to combine your political advocacy work with direct action. Let's do this ourselves. So when I discovered that there were these testing kits, these chemical reagents that, again, the government of the Netherlands was using, they would set booths up at these events where people use ecstasy, and you'd scrape a tiny bit of the pill onto a white ceramic plate, and you'd put a drop of this chemical on, and you could tell whether there was actually MDMA in the pill or not.
Right.
I realized what a magical thing this was, because I could go out to events and try to organize people to change drug laws, you know, young people, and say, look, the drug war is not working, you know, we need to, you know, change these laws. But, you know, you hand out literature, but, you know, really, you're not going to galvanize people that way. But if you're actually helping them to be safe, then they're going to, like, you know, be impressed, right? And other people are going to help you. And they're, you know, and so it sort of grew this what began as sort of this, like, you know, let's, you know, more of a politically oriented activist sensibility in me kind of grew into a community that took care of itself, right? Dance Safe is a peer-based drug education nonprofit, and young people across the country are educating themselves and taking care of themselves. Really a beautiful thing.
It is. It's beautiful, and it's to me, it is, and I'm sorry I keep going back here, but I'm thinking about myself, selfish Duncan. And I'm thinking about perhaps many of the people listening, they're not like you. They want to help. We want to help. We want to do things to help the world. We think it would be beautiful to help the world, but we don't help the world. There seems to be this impenetrable magnetic barrier between us and going out there and becoming activists and organizing and doing these beautiful things. And I'm just curious about what the first moment you passed through that membrane.
Well, in my life, I passed through that membrane when I was a teenager and I went to an anti-death penalty protest just sort of off the cuff. I wasn't an activist at the time. I just said to myself, gosh, you know, I think I was 14, right? And I said, how could the government kill people when they tell us we can't kill people? It was this hypocrisy thing, right?
Right.
I didn't really have a social justice consciousness. But I took a bunch – three city buses to get there because I grew up in Florida and public transit was horrible. And it took like 3 hours to get to this protest. And there was just two people there. And they were with the American Friends Service Committee, the political wing of the Quakers. Mm. And they were also the first two gay adults, a man and a woman, they were both gay, who treated me with respect. Like I was this 14-year-old kid with a mohawk, and they asked me what I thought about things. And they offered me a ride home and took me by their office, and I introduced me to all their social justice literature and everything. And at that point, I sort of – you know, became an activist. They channeled my anger from this bad childhood, you know, into a productive capacity. And I'll never forget those two people because I think if I hadn't stumbled upon them, I could have easily gone down a more self-destructive road in my life. But, you know, my anger over, you know, what was happening in my childhood and whatnot sort of took on, you know, was channeled into this political activism. Now, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say there also might be something in me, right, that some of us are just a little more brazen, a little more courageous to take risks. You know, people told me I was crazy when I was going to test ecstasy tablets. Like, you're going to get arrested. I was like, I know. I want to get arrested. I saw this happen to the courageous needle exchange pioneers. Some of them spent time in jail. But now, look, even in states where it's needle exchange is not explicitly legal, the cops leave them alone because everybody knows this is saving lives.
Right.
So someone's got to do it. Someone has to have the courage. Well,
yes, no, I mean, we need you, and there's more of us than there are you, and I think, obviously, it's a cliche thing to say, but the world would be an absolute paradise if the majority of people became like you, and that's something that's always frustrating.
Thank you, Duncan.
Well, it's true. You know, it is true. If everyone just... it's an interesting thing, isn't it? You have some event that happens in your life. For a lot of people, it's a rough childhood, for sure. For some people, it's other things. But you have this event that creates a kind of energy, a radioactive energy tablet inside of you that if you don't channel that energy in the direction of helping the world, then you can only channel it in the direction of self-destruction. And it starts eating you from the inside out, and you become sunken in and cruel and awful and Machiavellian. And so I want to – when I get to talk to people like you, I want to figure out why have I not crossed that membrane in such a – I mean, I have a podcast and I talk to people like you, but
are you cruel and Machiavellian?
I have, you know, I have been, and I'm not right now. And I think a reason that I am not like cruel and Machiavellian is a lot of that has to do with my interaction with MDMA and, psilocybin and psychedelics and, I think that maybe those things didn't push me in the direction that they pushed you in, or that they pushed Rick Doblin in, or that they pushed some other activists in. But they certainly have made me hesitate when I could be an asshole in times that I wouldn't have hesitated.
Yeah, no, they've had a profound effect on me too. These substances can be extremely therapeutic. And it's good to see that's becoming more widely recognized now. The last 3-4 years especially, there's this huge cultural, rebirth of psychedelics. The younger generation, I think, is more courageous in coming out and advocating that, hey, yes, these things have helped me. So I have a lot of hope. You know, we have marijuana legalization. I think psychedelics ought to be next, and slow, you know, followed by all drugs eventually. And I should really clarify this too, because this is very important for people to know. When most of the people in the drug policy reform movement, when you say you want to legalize drugs, you're not saying that because you want drugs to be accessible to, you know, more accessible to children. You're saying let's legalize drugs precisely for the opposite reason, because legalization actually means regulation. Prohibited drugs, when you prohibition is the abdication of regulation. It turns the manufacture and distribution of drugs over to criminals. And so when I say I think we need to legalize MDMA, it's because providing adults with safe legal access to the drug will eliminate the criminal market and make drugs and MDMA less available to minors. And I think that's a good thing. I actually have a teenage stepdaughter, and she tells me that she can buy Molly from half a dozen kids in her school. Molly, whatever it you know might contain. But to get alcohol, she at least has to find an adult to buy it for. When illicit drugs are more available to teenagers than legal drugs, something's wrong.
That's right. And it's one of those obvious truths that is so obvious. The fact that it's being suppressed, that obvious truth, just gives me chills, because I contemplate quite often, why are these substances prohibited? And I was wondering if you could help me answer that question. What is the rationalization from the federal government for keeping MDMA illegal?
Well, I think this goes back to LSD in the 60s and sort of an accident of history. But interestingly, it involves PTSD, right? When LSD became popular in the 60s, the Vietnam War was happening. And the young adults who were being drafted to go to Vietnam witnessed the effects of war on their parents, because World War II was a horrendous war. Probably there hasn't been an experience in this country where we had more people with post-traumatic stress disorder than we did after World War II. Of course, they called it shell shock back then.
Right.
They didn't call it PTSD. But and the way that we as a society tried to deal with PTSD back then after World War II was to repress it, right? If you look at 50s culture, everyone loves to make fun of it now. You see, you know, Father Knows Best and the show tunes, now is the best time of our life. And it's all like, you know, but the kids growing up with fathers who had PTSD and came back, they saw the suicides, they saw the domestic violence, they were beaten. And it was such a contradiction to what they were seeing on TV. Their society was telling them, look, everything's great. That's why you had folks like Timothy Leary and others whose message was anti-establishment, right?
Right.
Tune in, turn on, drop out. So LSD became a rebellious thing that was not only about, you know, screw this war, you're not going to put me through the same shit you put my parents through, right? It was, you know, screw the establishment, right? That scared the crap out of Nixon. It really did. Mm. And the elite at the time. And they thought that LSD itself was like somehow built into the drug, an anti-establishment kind of drug. And that led to this crackdown, which we call the second wave of the drug war. Because really the drug war began, you know, back in 1914 with heroin and alcohol prohibition at the same time. But this was sort of the second wave of it. Well, interestingly, you know, I don't think today there's many people that see psychedelic drugs as anti-establishment anymore. MDMA, when it became popular in the mid-80s, certainly wasn't wedded to any kind of anti-war or political movement. You know, people, in fact, can take MDMA and LSD and become more integrated into their society. So I think that fear is no longer driving the drug war today.
That's an interesting point you're making there. And I don't know if I agree with that 100%, because when I think of, because I don't look at integration as necessarily a great thing. And when I think of MDMA by itself is to me one of the most potent, powerful, therapeutic, relationship-enhancing drugs I've ever encountered. I've never seen anything so miraculous and profound chemically as that substance when it comes to bonding with someone else. It's amazing. But it's not just amazing in that way. It also has an incredible synergy with some other substances. For example, have you ever taken MDMA and psilocybin before?
No, I've never hippie flipped. No.
Okay. Well, the combination of those two substances is so incredible. And the experience that I think people have on it is so profound that because you don't just get the sort of bonding, beautiful, love-filled, nirvanic bliss that can come from a great MDMA trip, but you also get that kind of DMT level, I mean, depending on the dosage of mushrooms, you know, the DMT level visuals that sort of bring you out of your existence and you enter into Terrence McKenna land where
Right. You're
no longer, you realize that you are a super consciousness that seems to have become entangled with your body and that, you know, death suddenly is not this awful thing to be afraid of, but more like a Hawaiian vacation that's waiting for everybody at the end of their lives. And Right. That leads you to a feeling of disattachment in the best way possible from the things that society seems to want you to be so attached to. So that doesn't seem to really integrate you so much with a hyper-materialistic society. It seems that perhaps they're still afraid.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And even the pure MDMA experience, which doesn't have those kinds of fireworks, you know, that's more about love and empathy, that certainly also kind of goes against the old competitive, cutthroat corporate culture that we're all raised in, you know. And some of the folks I interviewed for my film, which we haven't talked about yet, some of the experts have said that there could be a very deep way in which MDMA has changed culture, making the younger generation a little less competitive, a little more cooperative, more into, you know, helping each other, helping the environment, et cetera.
Yes. And this is the thing that I don't want to believe that there's a cartel of powerful people who are aware of the fact that psychedelics are opening windows to this truth that is letting us peer out of the conditioning and the sort of like, it's like being in solitary confinement and a symbolic solitary confinement created by the interweaving of all the non-truths that you've been told since you were a baby. And for a second, you're sitting in this solitary confinement, the subjective solitary confinement cell where you don't know anything. And then all of a sudden this window pops open. You look through the window, you realize that you are in this incredibly beautiful, expansive, super intelligent matrix of life. And it is terrifying to me to imagine that there are people who are going around the world right now at this moment, slamming those windows shut whenever they can. Oh, Yeah. Shut that down. Shut that window. Don't look out that window. No, that window is, you've gone nuts. Shut it down. Shut it down. Shut it down. That's fucking scary to me, man.
I think they don't understand it, Duncan. I think that more it's just there's a lot of people that operate from fear. And they're afraid of, you know, the terrorists, the communists, etc. They tend to be religious conservatives because studies have shown, if you look at some of the research with MRIs into conservative and liberal attitudes, that conservatives are more motivated by negatives, right? When the things that could go wrong, it really motivates them, whereas liberals are more motivated by hope, right? That things, potential positives are more motivated.
Right.
Than liberals. So I think it's just that psychedelics scare people. And they particularly scare people because of their therapeutic potential, because a lot of people are repressing a lot inside them, especially things like, you know, pleasure. They think to themselves, look, I I've sacrificed, I'm not indulging, you know, and they see drugs in general as these hedonistic things, you know, especially if you look at pictures of hippies in the 60s as all free love and sex. And yes. So there's this idea that it's about hedonism. And I think that scares people who are haven't really come to terms with their own desires, you know, the stereotypical Republican who's anti-gay, but really he's gay himself. So he's repressed. And so psychedelics will bring up, you know, especially MDMA, it has this ability to kind of force you to confront things that you're repressing. And that scares people.
Yes, it does. I mean, it scares the shit out of people. And it seems that the way that these people are reacting to fear is violence. And, you know, I was actually at the Comedy Store, and I was talking to somebody who I'd met at this Alex Gray rave, and she was telling me about one of her friends just went to jail for 12 years for LSD and ecstasy. He had LSD and ecstasy. I think he had a vial of acid or something and ecstasy in his pocket. And now he is in jail for 12 years. 12 years. And that kind of thing... man, that kind of cognitive dissonance, I could walk around my house just squealing, 12 years? 12 years? 12 years. Because to me, if what you're saying is that these drug policies are in place because of the opinions of frightened, repressed conservatives who have a religious agenda, then that makes me think that the servants of Satan are in control. That sounds like what the devil would do, doesn't it? It sounds like if there was Satanists, and I'm just using this symbolically, I don't think there's some dark Luciferian entity that exists in the universe necessarily. I'm not positive about that, but I don't want to believe that. But if there were, what would his servants do? His servants would actively, violently try to divert people from the truth at all costs.
Yeah. There's some sinister stuff out there, Duncan, for sure. You know, the banning LSD has only created 25i N-bomb, which maybe you've never heard of, but this is the first drug that is active on a microgram level that can kill you if it's just slightly too much. And, you know, there was a big bust in the missile silo where the DEA busted Leonard Picard, one of the big – is that his name? Something Picard.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
And really, it really did dramatically reduce the amount of LSD in this country. It was hard to find. And I'm sure a lot of the DEA that participated in that are patting themselves on the back saying, look, what a good job we've done. We protected the children. But all it really did was cause the proliferation of other new synthetic imposter drugs like 25i N-bomb that are much more dangerous and are killing about one person a month. So we banned the safer psychedelics that have a track record. And all we're doing, because you can't stop the desire to alter your consciousness, there is always going to be a huge percent of the population that want to do that and people to fulfill the demand. And now it's being filled with drugs that are much more dangerous. It's crazy. But it's crazy. Going back to the evil here, there are people out there who think, well, that's a good thing if people die when they take what they think is LSD.
Yeah, you're right.
Ugh. It sends the message to others that it's dangerous.
Oh, God, you're right. You're right.
Because they're not trying – they're not public health oriented. They're not trying to save lives as much as they're trying to save souls. And if you already are going to sin and take an illicit drug, then you're gone in their minds. Then, you know, you're not worth living anyway. But your death, it will set an example for other young people who haven't yet decided to cross that line into sin yet. This is how they think.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's 2015. It's 2015. And there are cultists in the world who have organized a system of repressing chemicals that contain within them keys that unlock doors in the human mind to great, vast archives of information that can only benefit our species, and they are they want people to die for going into those libraries. It's 2015. This is no different to me than burning books. This is no different to me than any other time tyrannical forces have tried to place their heel on the flow of information. And for whatever reason, we are still stuck in a period of human history where we only think of information as the data encoded in books and the data encoded in recorded conversations or movies. We don't understand that there's data encoded in chemical compounds. We don't understand that yet, but there is, isn't there? There is.
Sure, sure. You know, though, I don't want to scare people away. We should talk about some of the positive things.
We'll get into the positive. I'm sorry. You got to let me howl at the moon for a second. I swear to God, I'll turn it away. And you guys always do this. You know, the Grays did it too. Like, I start, like, at a moment's notice, I will definitely become Chicken Little and start freaking out over the stuff. And I'm just giving voice to the frustration inside of me. But yeah, I know that there are good things happening. And
it's when I say that there's people like that out there, I'm not saying those are the people controlling the drug war. I don't believe they are. You know, I think most of them, though, you know, the Nixon cabinet folks are gone. Well, I guess Rumsfeld is still around, right?
Yeah.
but these days, I think it's mostly that people just they don't understand drugs. Because so few people use them, relatively speaking, right?
Right.
It's probably 5%, 10% max of the population has used any psychedelic drug, you know, within, well, at period, right? So people don't understand them. And then they don't believe those of us when we say these drugs are therapeutic, these drugs have benefits.
Yes.
They might think, oh, those are just those hedonistic. They just love feeling pleasure.
Druggies.
And justify their drug use, you know. And this is one of the reasons why MDMA, I think, was made Schedule 1 in 1985 by the DEA, despite a coalition of therapists suing the DEA when they placed it on emergency Schedule 1. And they went to court in front of an administrative law judge, and they had hundreds of hours of testimony from doctors and therapists who had been using it for almost 10 years with great results. And the DEA law judge, Francis Young, actually ruled in favor of the therapists and said MDMA should be Schedule 3.
Wow.
Clearly it has a medical value. But the DEA just chose to ignore their own judge's ruling because it was only an advisory hearing, and they kept it on Schedule 1. And I think the reason is because they were used to hearing people in the 60s saying that, you know, hippies and what, you know, saying LSD is therapeutic, et cetera. And they just didn't believe it because they were still in this mindset that we discussed earlier with, you know, this anti-establishment hippies that want to drop out and they hate America and all this kind of stuff.
Right. Well, you know, it is a I understand that the getting too shrill about it doesn't really help anything and sometimes can hurt things and more than it helps, I guess. So I know there needs to be a kind of moderate viewpoint when it comes to the gears that have to turn to make these things legal. But man, I really, you know, when I really contemplate, it's one of those things when I contemplate it and look at all the good that it's done for me and look at all the good that it's done for so many other people, both, you know, entrepreneurs and famous people and just regular people and soldiers. And when I look at all that and hear that someone's gone to jail for 12 years, it's a tough thing to swallow, which is why we need folks like you getting the good information out there, and which is why it's cool that you have actually made a movie. You've made the movie, right? You've shot it, or you're still in the process of making the movie?
And no, I'm still in the process. I've had 4 film shoots, and out of those, I put together a 9-minute short film on MDMA therapy, where I interviewed some veterans who participated in FDA-approved studies using the drug to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as a rape survivor and some others. But this is a film, short film I produced just sort of to show people that I can make a quality film. It's only on MDMA therapy. The full documentary is going to also cover harm reduction as an appropriate public health alternative to failed efforts at prohibition. I plan to fly to Europe, where not just the Netherlands, but many countries in Europe now are offering services to ecstasy users that far surpass what we're able to do legally here in the United States. And I want to juxtapose the successes that they've had in reducing medical emergencies and fatalities with the failures of U.S. drug policy, as well as the U.K. and Canada and Australia, the English-speaking world, where through their zero-tolerance drug war approach, we've seen, well, the latest statistics we have were back from 2012, where we had over 12,000 emergency room visits related to ecstasy or Molly. The vast majority of those were from fake or adulterated pills, and even the ones that came from pure MDMA or the fake. And you know, here, and we have to say, it's important to know there have been fatalities after an individual has taken pure MDMA. MDMA is not completely safe,
right?
And but I think that actually puts it in a category that makes it very appropriate to focus on for the next phase of the drug policy reform movement, because it shares a lot of qualities with marijuana, which is completely safe, and we have seen some progress, a lot of progress now on legalization, shares those qualities along with some of the qualities of the harder drugs that are more problematic to deal with. And because I'm an activist for drug policy reform across the board, I want to, you know, give an argument and help this movement move forward so that we have rational drug policy and keep everyone out of jail. Addicts don't deserve to be in jail any more than ecstasy users, even if their drug of choice isn't as therapeutic as ecstasy or the psychedelics.
Exactly, you know? Man. That's exactly right. Well, no one deserves to be in jail because they wanted to experience pleasure and they took their own biochemistry into their own hands. That is not a crime. That is not illegal. There is nothing. It's illegal, but it's not a crime. It's not a sin. It's just an exploratory person who maybe is self-destructive deciding that they want to... You know, man, I just watched this documentary last night. It's a pretty good documentary. It's on Netflix, and it's about these guys who want to climb K2. You know K2, that deadly mountain? It's in Nepal? Hold on, I'll look it up. I don't know where. Look, I'm sure I'll get fat. No matter what I say, I'll fuck it up. So I'm sorry, all mountain experts out there, prepare for me to mess something up about K2. But, well, I won't even go into details about it, aside to say that it is a mountain that is somehow deadlier than Everest. It's like, this is the one of the most insurmountable, horrible, cruel, monstrous beasts. And, you know, it draws mountain climbers to it.
Man, anyone that wants to climb that needs to go to rehab immediately.
Yeah, put them in jail. Put them in jail. It kills you. It kills like 20% of the people who try to climb it. That's a really dangerous fucking mountain. Let's get a fucking giant iron wall around that mountain and shoot anybody trying to go in. And then if someone does manage to get into that mountain, let's fucking take their money away from them. Let's take their home away from them. Let's take their family away from them.
Not only that, let's call climbing equipment paraphernalia and ban things like harnesses and carabiners.
Yes, exactly, man. It's like so what they're trying to do is they're trying to activate a biochemical change in their brain, which is what must just be the most stupid. Stupendous release of dopamine and serotonin anyone can experience once you finally clamber to the top of that awful peak. It just must be like the touching God. It must be like your brain turns into a clitoris. It must be so fucking incredible. It's so amazing, but they're doing it by climbing instead of by injecting, snorting, eating, or getting it into their bloodstream, so it's okay. But the moment that you decide, I'm going to actually put some information into my bloodstream and experience a heightened state of consciousness. Why? Because I want to. Because I exist in a dimension where I'm going to die. I have about 60, 70, if life extension therapy happens, 150 years to live in this temporary trance-like state we call human incarnation. And I'm going to play around with the colors that I can experience and the spectrum of experience. And the fact that there are sons of bitches out there who think that we aren't allowed to do that is something that really obviously, I'm sorry I keep going on these rants, but it really gets me puffed up like one of those puffer fish in the ocean when I think about it too much, just because it seems so absolutely absurd.
Yeah, well, let's talk strategy for a minute.
Okay.
how are we going to affect rational drug policy in this
shrill country? Ranting, my friend. Yeah. Shrill ranting. That changes everything. All you have to do is high-pitched shrill ranting with I guess that's – I don't know, man. Help us.
To provide everyone who thinks like us with the language to articulate a winning argument. And here is that winning argument. I can't stress this enough. Marijuana has made its gains largely based on a civil rights argument. Leave us alone. This is a good drug. It helps me. It's medicinal, et cetera. Yeah, not everyone likes it, but nobody's ever died from it. You know, look at how dangerous alcohol is. It makes no sense to promote marijuana. That's great. But marijuana has something very, very unique that most other drugs don't have, a quality of it, and that is it is the safest recreational drug in existence.
Right.
Nobody's died from – I don't think anyone's died from mushrooms or peyote or LSD either. But those drugs are so unknown. So few people have used them. It's hard to win with that argument.
Right.
And then with MDMA and any other drug you want to talk about, there have been deaths. And so the argument, the winning argument, needs to be legalization and regulation to strip the control and distribution of drugs from criminals,
right,
allowing adults legal, safe access, and thus reducing access to children. Can't stress that enough. That's what's going to win reform, because I have a stepdaughter, and I care. I worry, like every parent does, about kids getting in trouble with drugs.
Right.
Just like we don't let our kids eat sugar because their brains haven't evolved enough to be able to delay gratification, and all they would do is eat candy and ice cream all day long.
Right.
Parent knows that. So you don't want your kids taking pleasure drugs too that can, if you use them too much, kill you or cause addiction,
right,
et cetera. We want to wait until young people are old enough. Now, maybe we disagree on that age, and teenage years, it's different for every child, but there's got to be some arbitrary age that we just say, look, as a society, this is what we're saying. I think it should be 18. I think it should be 18 with alcohol, you know?
Right.
But it's 21, whatever it is, we have to put out an argument that's reasonable to protect children from substances, including sugar, that can be potentially dangerous, right? It's why we got to get sugar out of schools. That's why that movie, that documentary, Fed Up, is such an important documentary, you know?
Right. Yeah. The idea is like, come on, are you seriously thinking that your kids aren't taking drugs because they're illegal? That's ridiculous. You know what my drug dealer was like when I was in high school, man? Holy shit. He had like porn magazines scattered all over the floor of his trailer, unidentifiable animal bones scattered everywhere. It looked like straight out of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the house. I'm not even joking. Like bone wind chimes. And like, you know, he was freely just selling drugs to high school kids. He didn't care. He was just like, whatever, he's making fucking money. And
right. And
we would go there and buy the drugs, and we would go off and do them feeling like the most vile criminals on earth. So every single trip slightly tainted by the dishonesty. Now that's another, this is another aspect of it. There's the way that these prohibition is hurting families is not only are kids having to sneak around to get drugs, but they're having to be dishonest with their parents when they do drugs. So
right. They
take these drugs, they have these spectacular experiences, they gain all this information, they get all this wisdom, they probably have shit tons of questions to ask their parents because suddenly they just got this huge download of truth into their brains, and they can't mention it, because if they mention it, their parents are going to take them to a drug rehab, they're going to start giving them piss tests, they're going to kick them out of the house potentially, they're going to call the cops, and it's going to be awful. So, you know, that's the other side of it. It's not just these kids are, because of the prohibition, being exposed to toxic chemicals that aren't what they say they are. They're also being taught to lie to the people they love the most, and they're lying in their pursuit of truth. It's fucked up, man. It's fucked up.
It's even worse than that, Duncan, and it's a point that I try to make all the time, because I didn't really know this until I started working with Dance Safe, and I've spoken to and counseled, you know, thousands of young people over the years, and I firmly believe that prohibition and the culture created by the drug war not only causes young people to lie to their parents, but actually manifests, it actually creates the very drug misuse and abuse that the prohibitionists claim they're trying to prevent. Because right. when you ban a drug and you send this message that drugs are bad, drugs are evil, if you do them, there must be something wrong with you, etc., it creates a relationship with the drug where the young person isn't even open to the idea of using it responsibly. They don't see it as something to gain insight from, to learn from, to be moderate in, to respect. That's why we see this language among teenagers, let's get fucked up, dude, and bragging about how many pills you've taken, pushing your limits and things like that. You know, there's always going to be some crazy people like that, but this cult, this is part of a culture of prohibition. And if we, you know, recognized these drugs as medicines, we would reduce that greatly. Just like teen drug use decreased after Prop 215 in California. And the best theory as to why is because all these young people thought, well, it's just a medicine that my parents do now. It's not this cool thing, you know?
Exactly. Because that's exactly right, man. You're teenagers. They want to go skittering off into the dark. And the moment this – if this substance, if any of these – if MDMA suddenly became associated with education, that it's a form of psychological education or
– therapeutic experience.
What's that?
A therapeutic drug.
Teenagers are going to be like, fuck that, man. I'm not going to do that goddamn sappy shit. It's going to make me not hate my parents? No, thanks. I don't want to do that. Because I really can't. I mean, here, let me just say some true blasphemy here. So this is blasphemy right now in the era that we're living in. But can you imagine what would happen if some parents and some kids and their kids who are estranged from them sat down for an evening with some therapists and took MDMA together? Can you imagine what that would do for a family? No, you can't. I mean, no one knows what it would. Well, you can imagine, but we don't know, because that, if that came out, oh shit, a family took ecstasy with their kids they were having problems with, they would all get hauled away to jail. They'd lose the kid.
I wish I could remember her name, but there is a life coach, this woman. Gosh, I talked to her on the phone, but you should Google her, because she did that and she came out every year for like 5-10 years in a row. Her entire family, her kids, all got together and did MDMA once a year on like Christmas Eve or something like that. And she's got a website, and she's got a TED talk, or at least a video on YouTube about it. I can't remember her name, but yeah, no, she did it. And there are a lot of other people that have too. I took MDMA with my father before he died.
Wow. What was that like?
It was great. You know, I can't reveal too much personal stuff about it, but I can tell you this. After, and I was an adult, right? I was 30 years old at the time, and he lived a long time after that, and we only did it once. But after that, every time we talked to each other on the phone, we would say "I love you" to each other, and that never happened before that EMA session.
God, that's so beautiful.
He didn't change. But our relationship changed, so that was good.
Well, you know, man, this is good work that you're doing, and I think a lot of people are going to want to get involved in some way or another. I hope that people
if you want to do something that can help right now, you can go to my crowdfunding campaign and donate some money. There's 10 days left. I've raised $46,000 so far. I chose $100,000 as my goal. I'm still a little hopeful because I've been talking with some funders who might kick down some big amounts. But you can help right now. The easiest way to get there is just go to my website, mdmathemovie.com, and you'll see the link right there to go to the crowdfund, the Indiegogo site. And there's a video of me explaining what the movie's about. You can watch my first short film on MDMA therapy. And there's about 12 to 15 other short videos that I've put together out of the footage from my first four film shoots. You can watch and learn a lot about this unique drug.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great chatting with you, and let's do it again soon.
Thanks, Duncan. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Thanks for listening, guys. That was Emmanuel Sfirios. You can donate to Getting MDMA the Movie Made. Links are going to be at duncantrussell.com. Thank you guys for bookmarking the Amazon portal. If you like the podcast, give us a nice rating on iTunes. And thank you guys so much for continuing to listen to this show. Hare Krishna. See you later on in the week.